Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about psychology and happiness. But first, almost 4 months ago, an ex-Russian spy and his daughter were hospitalized in the UK after coming into contact with a substance known as Novichok, a nerve agent developed by Soviet scientists during the 1970s and 80s. And just recently, two more people, this time UK citizens, have been hospitalized. One has died after apparent exposure to Novichok. Russia has so far denied any involvement in the attacks. British police report they have found the source of the latest nerve agent poisoning, a small bottle in the home of the hospitalized victim. Police are still trying to find where the bottle came from. Luckily, though, the good news is a brush with a nerve agent is not always fatal. Surviving an encounter with one has a lot to do with basic chemistry, which we're going to be talking about now, the chemistry of poisoning agents. Let me introduce my guest. Rick Sockleben is a retired chemist and member of the American Chemical Society. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
So one of our listeners actually asked me this question last week and wanted to know, and I said, you know, that's a great question. Let's find out about it. So I'm going to ask you, how do these nerve agents work?
Okay. Well, I'll regress just a little bit and describe that the nervous system, how the nervous system works. And cells, nerve cells send their messages by releasing chemicals called neurotransmitters. Those neurotransmitters, when they're released, go across to the receptor cell and cause a signal there. And then that whatever happens after that happens. Now, one of the neurotransmitters is called acetylcholine or acetylcholine. And it's actually used in a lot of different nerve pathways, but one of them is the to control muscles, so with a muscle firing. So when you want to send a signal to a muscle to fire, it goes down through a nerve system, and acetylcholine is released, and it goes across, and then the muscle fires. It contracts. The problem is, with that is now the muscle's contracted, and as long as that acetylcholine is still around, it's going to stay contracted, and you're going to get paralysis. So to get rid of that acetylcholine so that the muscle can relax, the body has an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase, or ACE, and that's actually where these nerve agents work. When you get exposed to the nerve agent, it goes in, and it interacts, it binds to this ACE enzyme and actually chemically binds to it and prevents it from breaking down acetylcholine, and therefore the muscles can't relax and you get paralysis. Now, there's a lot of other effects in the body as well, but that's the primary one.
So there are many different classes of nerve agents. Novichok, which I just mentioned being one of them, are they all more or less the same, or is this a particularly deadly one?
Well, my understanding, I'm not an expert on the different agents, so this particular one I only know from the same reports that everybody else has access to. But presumably, it was developed to be a particularly powerful one. There's a lot of agents that act in this way. Some of them are used as pesticides quite broadly. They happen to have more; they're more effective against the ACE enzyme in insects than in people. Every animal, every species has the enzyme's a little different, and some are more this way, some are more that way. And there's another thing, and that's the blood-brain barrier. In order to get to the nerves, these chemicals have to pass the blood-brain barrier. So if you build one that does that very efficiently, it's going to be more powerful. So you just tweak the chemistry until you get the properties you want, which is maybe very strong against insects but not against people, or very strong against people.
Are there antidotes for these nerve agents?
Yeah, there are, actually. There are a couple different ways of treating this. One is to use a chemical which will bind to the acetylcholine receptor, but not cause a signal. So if you put a chemical in there, and one of them is atropine, it goes in, and it binds to that receptor, so it kicks the acetylcholine out. So the muscle cell relaxes. The problem is that's poisonous too, you know, too much of it, because now the muscles are relaxed and they won't contract. So you have to have a balance there with that type. There's another one, and they're actually, it's pretty interesting. It goes in and it actually interacts with that ACE enzyme, and it goes in and it actually cuts loose the piece of the nerve agent that was attached to the enzyme. And when it goes in and it takes that piece off again, then the enzyme's active and you restore the function of the enzyme. So you can break down the acetylcholine. So both of them work. One of the first one that blocks the receptor, it's pretty fast. Yeah. So when you give that to a person, it pretty quickly works. But you have to be really careful because it can give them too much. The other one takes time because it has to get there. It has to reactivate these enzymes. So it's slower. So, but I think in most cases of a severe poisoning, the treatment would probably involve a little bit of both. And over time, they would change.
And you would have to get to the victim in time before the damage is, too much damage is done.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, and it seems like the idea here, as in other kinds of poisonings or other diseases, is to work on the symptoms, right? See if you can keep them alive enough so that the body might help out in fighting back.
Sure. Well, that's what the receptor blockers. That's what they do. They really treat that symptom. The ones that reactivate the ACE, they are actually fixing the enzyme. They're putting it back. Hmm. But a lot of damage has been done. You know, so you might be able to. So the first thing they're going to do is they see that you have these symptoms and breathing is difficulty breathing and, you know, you may have irregular heartbeat, things like that. They're going to treat those symptoms first, right off the bat. They, I mean, even before anything else. Now, they'll hit you with atropine if they know that you've got a chemical agent exposure, but they wouldn't know that if they just found somebody down on the street. You know,
right.
Wondering like has happened in the British cases. So they really have to figure out what the problem is. But they can treat you with, you know, just the kind of standard medical treatments that keep you alive. And then they start the chemical treatments once they realize, hey, we have a nerve agent poisoning here.
I understand that the nerve agents go way back to World War II origins, or as far back as a German insecticide.
Yes. Yeah. So the most common class of nerve agents. There were the first reports on this class of chemicals having certain effects was probably in the 1800s. But then in the 30s, a group at a German chemical company were aware of these reports, and so they started studying this class of chemicals to see whether that could be useful for anything. And they found certain chemicals that were very effective against insects, against the ACE enzyme in insects. And so these were developed as insecticides. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they also found out that they were toxic to mammals, not as toxic as they are to insects, but certainly they are toxic to mammals. And the military finds these things out, and they're starting to ask questions about what can we do with this stuff. So, you know, that's pretty much, you know, throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
Technology advances in through various drivers. And the military applications are always one of them.
Are they still around as insecticides?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I was checking on this before I came in, and it looks like probably half of the insecticides used in the world today are the organophosphates, which are in this class, and the largest other one is the carbamates, which are also in this class. So these ACE inhibitors or binders are really one of the major pathways for insecticides to act.
I'm scared.
Well, the interesting thing is that we've worked for over, you know, decades and decades to come up with pesticides that are insecticides that are safer to use, that are less toxic to people and more toxic to the targeted insects that we want to hit.
I know, but that's half of them are still, half of these organophosphates are still around. Or are still used in half
the
insecticides. They're used all the time.
Extremely valuable. Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, malathion is one of the most important insecticides we have for fighting flies and for disease-carrying insects. So ticks, flies, but you just have to be careful how you use it. You know, it's like a lot of things, you know, used properly. And the other thing is the insecticides are designed to break down quickly in the environment.
Hmm.
The nerve agents that are designed for warfare-type uses are actually designed not to break down readily because you want them to stick around. So the insecticides, you want to spray them out there. The bugs get it, get hit by it. They die, and then it goes away, and it's not there anymore. And with the nerve agents, you want to spray it around, and then anybody who happens to be walking through the grass gets it on their skin and absorbs it, and, you know, that's it.
What determines whether someone will die after an exposure to a nerve agent?
Probably, I'm just guessing from pharmaceutical background, two things. One is dosage. How much do they get exposed to? And then two is their personal sensitivity, because we're all a little different, you know. So pretty much that's it. How much you get exposed to and your personal sensitivity. Some people are going to be more sensitive and some people less sensitive. And that'll also vary with the agent a little bit. But
what about Novichok? Do you know about that?
No idea.
No.
No. But I suspect from everything that they've said about this agent, the exposure must have been fairly low because it's pretty nasty stuff. And I know that some of the more common ones that have been, and these have all been outlawed. I mean, nobody's supposed to have any of these anywhere. You know, there's some very, very limited specific laboratories that are allowed to have these basically for diagnostic type purposes, but they're not supposed to be out there. We agreed in 97, I think, to get rid of them all, and most everybody's claimed to have done so.
How do you get rid of a nerve agent?
There's a couple of ways. One way is to...
Give me one way because I haven't that much time.
Okay, one way is to chemically react it. So the most common way is you mix it with something that it'll react with, and lye is one of the things it reacts with. You have to be careful doing it, though, because you don't want to handle the stuff.
No, I can.
Right, and you want to make sure you destroy all of it because if there's a little bit left, it can still be hazardous.
All right.
So it's a challenge.
Doctor, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You're very welcome.
Dr. Rick Sokleben is a retired chemist and a member of the American Chemical Society. When we come back, we're gonna talk about Starbucks and coffee and stirrers and straws and things like that. So. What are they doing to do away with all those straws? And everybody's jumping in on that. We'll talk about it after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Science Friday is supported by Wix.com. Did you know you can get a professional website in 5 minutes or less? It's true. Wix.com developed artificial design intelligence that builds a stunning website just for you. You can even do it right from your phone. Here's how it works. Go to Wix.com, decide what you need a site for, pick your style, add your images, and your website is ready. Now that's the future. Go to Wix, WIX.com, to create your website today.
Hi, I'm Bassem Youssef. I have a new show, Remade in America, presented by Cafe. I'm exploring what it's like to be an outsider in this country. I'm talking to people from all walks of life, people like me who came here from other countries, and people who were born here but never felt like they totally fit in. Like our recent guest, Cameron Esposito.
When I realized I was gay, I was at a college where you could be kicked out of school for being gay.
Join us as we talk about America from a totally different perspective.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, coffee giant Starbucks said it would start phasing out plastic straws in its stores, moving instead to sort of an adult sippy cup lid by 2020. And they are not alone, because other restaurants and at least one airline, American, are also moving away from the ubiquitous plastic straw, something spurred by environmental concerns, other times by government regulations. But what's next for your beverage if you don't have the straw? Joining me now is Clint Rainey. He writes about the food industry for New York Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on.
What's the reasoning behind these shifts away from straws? Just too many cluttering up the environment?
Basically, yeah, right. The number that you always see cited is 500 million straws in America thrown out each day. There's a little bit of dispute about sort of the provenance of that stat. Apparently, there hasn't ever been an official study done into the number of straws that we throw out. But, you know, people agree it's probably more or less correct. So we're throwing away over 100 billion of them a year. It's enough to circle the Earth a couple of times. And those, they're not recycled easily. The the straw is able to sort of, I guess, literally fall through the cracks, if you want to talk about it that way, when they're going through the recycling machinery.
And there's so many of them because they're so cheap to make.
Exactly.
And so is finding an alternative very hard to the straw? How hard is that?
I think that there's certainly a lot of options out there already, but the one that that's going to make a viable claim as the new straw moving forward, I'm not really sure. Certainly paper is the material that a lot of people are gravitating towards. Cost-wise, it can be similar. This company Aardvark is sort of like the industry leader in paper straw manufacturing right now, and it claims its straws cost one penny more than the plastic ones, which is, I mean, it can add up, but they also claim if you hand them out on request instead of just giving them out by default to customers that you might even make some money on the trade-off.
And that seems to be one of the keys, that it's not going to take a lot of replacement to make a big difference, is it?
Right. And it's sort of a, you know, it's a culturally ingrained habit that we have. When we are given a cold beverage, especially, we think, where's the straw? Right. But if you just make yourself, which is something I started doing after I wrote this thing, drink cold drinks without a straw, it's just fine. You know, you're not exactly losing anything.
Are people coming up with you brought some examples of straw alternatives? Show us what you got here.
So I guess I'll start with the most ridiculous one in my opinion, which I can just sort
pull
of
out
here.
There you go.
If this looks like a piece of bucatini pasta to you, that's because that is exactly what that is.
Long piece of tubular pasta.
Yeah, it's like about an 8-inch long piece of pasta, and this comes from a restaurant and private beach in Malibu called the Paradise Cove Beach Cafe. The owner sent me some in the mail that he didn't package very well, so this is actually half the number I was sent. The others came in a bunch of pieces. But the
they give that out to their customers?
They switched over entirely. Right. Yeah. He said they were going through about 100 million plastic straws a year.
One place.
And they decided to look into what the alternatives were. He had this like Yahoo moment where he remembered going to Italy and seeing these giant pieces of pasta, and these are sourced from Italy, and they use them. I mean, it's sort of a gimmicky thing too. Mm-hmm. They can claim to be the beach restaurant that serves you your margarita with the giant piece of pasta sticking out of it. He says they last 4 hours thereabouts in liquid, and I put that to the test. It does last about 4 hours. Then it melts away into like a pretty gross looking wet pasta noodle. But
what else do you have?
So I have just your standard. I brought just a kind of your standard paper straw as well.
That's an old. I remember those. I'm old enough to remember paper straw.
These actually go back to 1888. Most people,
but the straw.
Exactly.
Right.
This was created by a guy named Marvin Stone. He was an inventor who was tired of getting little pieces of literal straw. That's what was used at the time in his mint juleps, and he fashioned this machine that could swirl paper with some glue and then some wax on the outside into a cylindrical structure that you can drink out of. And the company I mentioned earlier, Aardvark, is the sort of modern-day company that he started back at the end of the 19th century. I also brought a metal one.
A metal straw, yes.
Yeah, I mean, these have been around for a long time, too. This is actually my own straw. I was given it as a part of a Christmas gift, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 years ago. But the plus side to this is that it's always reusable. The plastic and the pasta have a very limited shelf life, but the metal can be reused into perpetuity. The downsides are that they are very expensive and that they require a very cumbersome cleaning process. They have a brush that you have to run through the center of them, especially if they're being used at a restaurant that goes through a lot of straws. The staff isn't going to appreciate that job, probably. So the pasta one's a little bit of an outlier, but the metal and paper are the two big alternatives that places are turning to.
Need a giant autoclave for that.
yeah,
that's how you clean it. One issue, you know, that has been raised by people has been people with disabilities. Many of these alternatives are not good options. They need a straw. Right.
That's true.
Do you think restaurant is going to say no more plastic straws, or they keep some behind the counter just to give out to the people who really need them?
That, from the people I spoke with, that is the system that they seem to be gravitating towards right now. Union Square Hospitality Group, which is where that paper straw that I held up a second ago actually came from. It came from Gramercy Tavern. They have a similar system where they're holding on to a couple that can be used, you know, on request. And the metal ones are particularly bad if you have some sort of tremor or something like that. That would be a bad thing to be forced to have to use. So I think moving forward, I think Starbucks said this too when it made its announcement about the giant sippy cup, was that it would just continue to offer a very, very tiny number of them, since the number of people who would be requiring one is certainly not going to be large.
Are there drinks that are leaders in straw innovation?
There are. Obviously, milkshakes and things like that are an area where you have to have a straw. You can't do what I said earlier and just refuse to stick one in it. This sort of came out earlier this year that within sort of the boba tea industry, there are a lot of – they've had to – they're a place where you can't you have the straw because the tapioca ball at the bottom is going to be – you just – drank all of the liquid directly from the cup.
Stuff on bubble tea.
It would be pointless at the end. So they have been looking at ways to. I think it doesn't help the fact that their straw is an enormous plastic, and historically plastic straw. That if you're looking at the biggest offenders in the straw world, then theirs are going to come up on the radar first because they're giant and long and thick and whatever. So yeah, they've been sort of at the forefront of rethinking how to find a plastic alternative for their drinks.
But you know, necessity is the mother of innovation. Maybe, who knows, people will come up with stuff we haven't even thought about.
That's true.
You know, maybe some kind of innovative straw that people say, whoa, why didn't I think of that? You know, that sort of thing, because now there's an incentive to do that.
There is. Yeah. I mean, Starbucks, I'm going to say one thing about theirs really quickly, which I also brought here.
That's the new Starbucks
this is lid? Yeah, and that's the thing about it is it is extremely simple looking.
It is.
And they basically had someone work on an engineer working on this since 2016, and she basically took the hot lid cup and made the hole larger in it. It's an incredibly simple.
It's almost like a beer can top.
It is like
if you popped the top
exactly
and stuck that lid on it, it would look like a beer can top with that kind of opening in it.
Exactly. This one, interesting side note, is still a polymer. It's the exact same plastic that a straw is made of. It's just they're going to argue easier to recycle than those tiny little straws. But from a square inch argument or something, I'm sure that one of these lids is as much plastic as was being used before by the straws that they were handing out.
Just make it biodegradable, and then we've got a new thing here.
That is the next thing that they will get pressure to do, I'm sure.
Clint, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Great stuff. Clint Rainey writes about the food industry for New York Magazine. The final match of this year's World Cup happens on Sunday. Are you team Croatia or are you team France? Whichever team you're rooting for, you may have noticed some dives or flops from the players. Flopping, if you're not aware of this, flopping is faking an injury. It's very theatrical to get the attention of the ref, who will take notice and give the opposing offender a penalty. That, of course, is the idea. Well, FIFA, the ruling football body, has noticed this too and is taking action to try to stop the flop. Soccer players are notorious for dives, but there is a strategy to these flops. And joining me to discuss some of the science and strategies behind these soccer dives is Vox reporter Umer Erfan. He joins us via Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this. You wrote an article about the science and research behind flopping. Why were you interested in this?
Well, I play soccer myself, and I was trying to get some skeptical friends to watch with me. And this is, of course, the common complaint that soccer players dive, they look like wimps, they waste so much time. And I thought it was actually something to look into a little bit further. It's a part of the strategy in the game. And I was kind of curious as to why you see this in soccer, especially the really bad play acting, and not so much in other sports. And that's kind of what drove my interest here.
Has there been an increase in this year's World Cup?
I don't think it's been quantified just yet. I think we're still waiting for the dust to settle, and some of us are still going to the tape to see what actually was a real injury versus, you know, a fake.
Yeah, flopping has even gone viral. There's a Neymar challenge named after the Brazilian player who is the famous flopper.
That's right. But the other side of that is Neymar is also the most fouled player in this year's World Cup. And so the question is, you know, is he flopping to draw attention to the fouls that he's receiving as a way to sort of mitigate that effect, or is he just doing this to, you know, unfairly gain an advantage?
What do you think?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. If you're getting fouled and the referee is not calling it, you really want to try to get the referee's attention, and that may mean playing up something that was minor in order to keep his eye on something that was major. But, you know, the Mexican team was very upset that he burned so much of the clock in their game against them. And so some people consider that to be unsporting and also against the spirit of the game.
Now, flopping seems random, but you say there is a strategy. One study looked at when and where players take dives, and what did the researchers find?
So the researchers found that players are more than twice as likely to take a dive when the score is tied rather than when they're ahead or behind. So it means that players are actually kind of paying attention to the score, and they're actually making more of a conscious decision on where and when to take dives. And similarly, when they looked at the location of the field where they were taking dives, the closer they were to the opponent's goal, that is, you know, when they were on offense and within striking range, that's when they were more and more likely to actually, you know, hit the ground and scream in pain.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Myra Plato talking about flopping this soccer weekend finals coming up. You watch how theatrical some of these players are. They're rolling on the ground. They're diving. Faking an injury can be risky, right? I mean, isn't there some sort of risk-reward option that's going on in their mind?
Yeah, exactly. And the researchers that were looking at this, they were approaching this in the context of deception as we see it in the animal kingdom. So there's like a bird that's found in North America known as the killdeer that fakes injury to its wing in order to lure predators away from its nest. And the obvious cost is that, you know, the more you bait yourself to a predator, the more likely you are to be struck. In soccer, though, there's almost no downside to flopping. It's very rarely called out as a foul. And if the call doesn't go your way, you just get back up and start playing again. So there's very little disincentive, and there's a very strong payoff, and that's kind of why you see it more often in soccer.
But FIFA is doing something, right, trying to stop the dives?
That's right. They introduced the video assistant referee this year for the first time in the tournament, and they have actually overturned a dive, including one of Neymar's, after going to the tape and realizing that, you know, this was not a real injury. And certainly this is something that is going to start to have an effect. And I think we'll have to wait until after the tournament to try to see if it did actually change behavior.
Well, are you going to be looking for something in the finals at all, in the match, what we should expect to see in terms of dives?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at, you know, later in the game, if the score is tied, if you see a player go down on offense, very likely that's going to be a dive. And that's kind of like where the optimal time for diving is, because that may give you the chance to take a penalty kick, which can in fact win the game for you. So that's where you'll likely see it if it does happen.
Well, the penalty kick seems like luck, but there is research out there that the team that goes first has an advantage, right?
Yeah, there's also a lot of strategizing going on with penalty kicks. Soccer being such a slow scoring game, every single point has such value. So yeah, it shows there's research that shows that there's a first mover advantage to the teams that shoot first. But in this year's tournament, all four teams that shot first have lost the shootouts. So it doesn't necessarily hold in all instances. But if you are trying to strategize, your goal would be to shoot first and counterintuitively, one of your best bets might be just to aim straight down the middle rather than trying to aim for either the right or the left side of the goal.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was looking and thinking about this and reminding myself, hey, you know, soccer or football is not the only place you see people being theatrical about penalties. All you have mm-hmm. to do is watch an NBA game, right? And basketball players are doing this stuff all the time.
Yeah, and even hockey players, and you see NFL players do it as well. The issue is that in basketball, a foul or a flop will get you 1, 2, or maybe 3 points on the line, which won't really change the total outcome of the game. But in soccer, if you take a dive in the penalty box and you get a penalty kick, that's going to win the game for you right there and then. So the incentives are much stronger in soccer than they are in other sports.
Hmm. And you know, when you say taking a dive, it really is taking a dive. That's an old term for cheating or giving up early.
Yeah, I mean, you could perhaps see that in boxing matches.
Right,
that are...
exactly. Mm-hmm. Took a dive. Okay, this is quite interesting. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Umer Irfan is a reporter with Vox talking about the soccer finals that are coming up on Sunday. We're going to take a break when we come back. If you're feeling stressed out, we're going to talk about psychology and the good life. Stay with us to talk about a course at Yale that has 1,200 students signing up for it. Think of that. What a classroom. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When psychologist Laurie Santos posted her course at Yale, it was Psych 157, she expected perhaps a few hundred students to sign up. Instead, over 1,000, 1,200 wanted in. Dr. Santos studies primate cognition, looking for clues to how humans think and learn and behave, but she also teaches now the most popular class at Yale University, Psychology and the Good Life, or as many students call it, the happiness class. And she's here in our New York studios, Laurie Santos, professor of psychology and head of the Silliman College at Yale. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
What do you do with all those kids, 1,200 kids?
Well, you try to stick them somewhere. That was the real challenge, is like what classroom is going to fit everybody.
And why did you come up with that idea?
So it started being head of college at Silliman. So for folks that don't know, Yale is kind of like Hogwarts, where we have, you know, Gryffindor and Slytherin and things. So I'm head of Silliman, which means I live with students on campus and I hang out with them. You know, I eat with them in the dining hall and I hang out with them in their coffee shop. And it was interacting with students at that level that made me realize that students are much more unhappy than I think folks realize, particularly at college levels. And so it got me to look at the national statistics, and you find that over 30% of college students report being too depressed to function, over 50% say they feel overwhelming anxiety, over 80% feel overwhelmed by all they have to do. Like, this isn't the college of my youth.
Right.
It's a really stressful place. And as a psychologist, this was really frustrating because we know from the science of psychology all these things you can do to feel less stressed out and bump up your mood and so on. So I thought, you know, I'm a researcher. I can develop a course on these topics to teach students
right.
better ways to kind of behave and better strategies they can use.
You know, the fact that so many turned up pointed out how right you are.
Yeah,
right, about how stressed people, they wanted to go to the class to find happiness.
Yeah, I think two things. One is that really there was a need on campus,
yeah.
but also that students, you know, they don't want platitudes. Like, they really wanted to know what the research said about what they could do to feel better.
Mm-hmm. So to tell us in a very few words, what is happiness to your definition?
Yeah, so we in the class use the social scientist definition, which is a little clunky, but it's really about subjective well-being, which has two components. It's kind of what you think, like how satisfied are you with your life? If I just asked, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how satisfied are you? That's this kind of cognitive component. But there's also more of a feeling component, like what does it feel like? Do you have positive emotions most of the time? And that's kind of the affective side of happiness. And usually these things are measured in the way that social scientists measure things. There's lots of scales and so on. But really what it's just trying to capture is, like, how's your mood? Are you feeling like your life is going okay? And are you in a good mood a lot of the time?
Does control of your own life, is that a big part of happiness?
Yeah, I mean, what the research suggests is that having paths that you find meaningful, not just necessarily control, but feeling like you're doing things for a purpose, can be really powerful in terms of our mood.
Do we go chasing the wrong things in life?
I think the surprising amount of research suggests that, yes, that's the case. In fact, psychologists have a term for it. They call it miswanting, right?
Wanting the wrong things.
Yeah. I think what we tend to believe is if you think about what will make you happy, people think, I have to change something. You know, I have to change my circumstances, get a new job or get a higher salary or move somewhere new. But what the research shows is that our circumstances matter incredibly little for how happy we are. Researchers try to estimate it, which is kind of tricky, like, you know, how much does your circumstances matter, but they say that they matter only about 10% for your happiness. And so much more of it is the way you frame things and what behaviors you engage in.
Yeah, because you hear people who don't have a lot of money saying, you know, I've got other things. They're higher priorities. I'm very happy.
Yeah, and you also get people who've had, you know, terrible life circumstances, you know, get hit by a car and are paraplegic, and they say, well, that's taught me what's important in life. You know, I've never been happier since I stopped being able to walk. And it's shocking to our forecasts. Our minds don't think that will be good for us, but it fits with what the research tells us.
How much is our concept of we haven't got enough time to do things important?
This is another big one that researchers have been working on. Researchers talk about this concept called time affluence, which is a foreign concept, particularly to my Yale students, because we're always in the opposite, which is time famine, which is like somebody's like, you know, do you want to grab a coffee? You're like, sure. Like, when? You're like, I don't know, never. Like, I don't know. And we're constantly so scheduled that we don't even have these simple breaks for, you know, things that would make us happy, you know, having coffee with a friend. And so what the research suggests is that folks who prioritize their own time affluence are happier than folks that don't, even when that comes at a cost of, say, how much money you make. You know, if you'd give up salary time to have more free time, those folks tend to be happier on average.
But are these students willing to do that?
Well, when I taught the course, I was really worried about that. You know, I was going to give them this lecture on time affluence. And it also felt really ironic, right? I was going to make them read a paper and come to class. So we did this funny thing where we had students come to class on this time affluence lecture day. And they got there and they were handed a flyer that said, today's lecture is on time affluence. And to teach you about it, I'm going to give you some. You have no class today. And the only rule is that they couldn't use the time to study or, you know, prep for a midterm or something. They had to do something that increased their well-being. The amazing thing is that students completely lost it at this moment. You know, some students hugged me. One student burst into tears. This was like central midterm time on Yale's campus where everyone was really stressed. And I gifted them an hour.
Wow.
And one student even said this was the first free hour she had all semester. Just sad.
It is sad. 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Talking with Laurie Santos, professor of psychology and the head of the Silliman College at Yale University in New Haven. They were actually crying because they were so excited and relieved that you gave them an hour.
Yeah,
To do nothing.
And that was, and I actually gave students a list of things to do because I thought it would be so for, it was like, go to the art gallery, you know, take a break, you know, savor a bubble tea.
Do you shake your head at this? Say, how did this happen? Because you said when I was a student, we had none of these issues.
Yeah, I think partly student life is different, right? They're so focused on grades. They're so worried about what's going to happen in the future. They're just focused in this future-oriented way, in a way that I kind of wasn't in the 90s. But I think it's not just college students. I think all of us face this to a certain extent. You know, I tell my friends about time affluence, and my professor friends joke, like, man, I wish you could show up at my office and give me a flyer and tell me I had an hour off. You know, this isn't just college students who are facing
this. That's a good point. Your research involves studying non-human primates, animals such as rhesus macaques. Do they have insights into happiness that you learn teach other people?
I mean, the work on monkeys is a little bit different from happiness, but I think when you watch them, you realize they're doing a lot of the kinds of things that research on humans suggests would be good for humans to do to be happier. So, for example, they have tons of time for social connection, something that their work in humans shows is really important for happiness. I think they stay in the present moment all the time, you know, in part because their minds can't think
they're
about
mindful.
The future. They're mindful. You know, it's funny because the Buddhists talk about, you know, getting out of our monkey mind. That's our goal, to be in the present moment. But I actually think the monkey mind is in the present moment all the time. You know, they can't think about the future. They're not worried about what happened 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Could it be because parts of their, you know, I'm thinking about the prefrontal cortex idea, that it has not matured till like maybe you're 25. Could that be have something to do with why there's all this stress and pressure and time feelings?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that, but I think part of it is how these students are really spending their time. You know, they're spending much more time alone than we've ever seen in college days. And that comes a little bit through things like technology, right? There's this myth of social connection on things like Instagram and so on. But the research kind of suggests that you need to be there in person having these social connections. That's what matters. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the phones because we have people who'd like to chat with you. From Boston, Michael in Boston. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I was wondering if the research indicated any basic or notable differences for people on the autistic spectrum. I find that social interaction is sort of basically painful, and I find if I get what I want, I'm happy. And until, you know, maybe it's taken away, and I don't seem to have the regret that most people seem to have.
Good question. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely individual differences and important differences that come, you know, from things like being on the spectrum and so on. But again, the research suggests that our forecasts can be off, that even people who are incredibly introverted can benefit a little bit from having a bit more social interaction. And so I think that's the kind of major claim from the research, is that these things we forecast, the things we think are going to make us happy, don't necessarily make us as happy as we think. One of the things I struggle with is not just the social connection part, because I'm a Massachusetts native and don't like talking to people, even though the research suggests this. But another one comes from work suggesting that we'll feel better if we do nice things for others. You know, there's this lore in our life that we want to treat ourselves. But it turns out that if you're having a bad day, you'd be much better off not treating yourself, but treating someone else. And this is something that I have to very explicitly make myself do. You know, I want to get a manicure myself, or I want to get a nice latte. I don't want to gift somebody else a nice latte. But in fact, that would make me feel better.
That's the argument I always use on Pitch Week on public radio, is you will feel better if you gift it this public radio station.
It's true. The science bears this out.
Yeah. 844-724-8255. You know, you say you see the difference between your generation and these kids. Has social media played a large role in this?
I think it really has. I mean, it's tricky to nail down exactly what the causes are, but I think social media is this real opportunity cost on the kinds of things that make us happy. So the list of things I give students are things like social connection with real people in real life. You know, the more you're on Facebook or Instagram, the less you actually talk to real people. A second thing that we find is that a really important thing for well-being is just sleep. And one of the things we know is that students who are on social media later at night are sleeping less and less. In fact, there's some terrifying statistics of how many 15-year-olds sleep with their phones. It's about 80% of 15-year-olds who have phones sleep with them in their bed. And so, you know, this is impacting our sleep. It's impacting our social connection. It's definitely impacting our ability to stay in the present moment. You know, the first thing I do when I'm standing in line at the coffee shop, as soon as there's a moment of pause, is to take out my phone and, you know, plop on Twitter. And that's just breaking up how much we're paying attention to the real world.
Do we need to teach kids mindfulness more of that?
I think so. And the research suggests that these kinds of techniques, like meditating over time, can have much bigger effects than we think and more quickly than we think. You don't need to be an extra meditator and spend 30,000 hours to get a big effect.
Let's go to Renee in Cleveland. Hi, Renee.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's a two-pronged question. First, I was wondering if you've done any research to scale down to, like, high school and middle school, or up to just the general population that's working. And then also, as an educator, how do you give your students the ability to have more time to engage in this kind of behavior? So thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, really great question. So on the kind of scaling upward side, we realized that so many people are interested in this stuff that we've decided to make the content of the class available for free to anyone who wants to take it. So right now on Coursera.org at Yale site, you can take a shorter version of this class completely for free. And it's kind of caught on. Right now we have over 130,000 learners, which is kind of incredible. But I really love that the caller brought up kind of bringing this downward to K through 12 students, because the kinds of patterns that we're seeing right now in college students, we see the same kinds of patterns in high school students, and that worries me. And it gets to her second question about, you know, what we can do to give kids more time affluence. You know, one of the things I think we are seeing is that high school students are more stressed than ever, in part because they have way more homework and way more academic stress than ever.
Is that right?
I was just visiting an elite high school, and they gave me their stats on all their students, and one of the things buried in there, we kind of two facts that were worrying for well-being. One is that these high school students report getting only 4 hours of sleep on average, which research suggests is enough over time to induce psychosis and depression and all these things. But at the same time, these stats reported that these students have 4 to 5 hours of homework on average a night per person. And I think, again, with that much homework and then these hits on well-being and sleep, we can't be achieving our educational mission with this much work. And so my advice to teachers is to find some ways to scale back, because we might be doing something that's really counterproductive both for students' learning and for their health.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Laurie Santos, professor of psychology at Yale University. My question about all of these things is you can bring a horse to water, but can you make it drink?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Can you tell students things that they, will actually listen to? It's certainly at that age.
Yeah. Well, it's not just listening. It's like you can have the best of intentions, and it's still hard to change your behavior. This is why we're in July, and I'm sure half your listeners have forgot completely about their New Year's resolutions that they made, just 6 months ago or so on. And that's why one of the things we tried to do with the course was to really harness the science on this. The class focused a lot on the science of behavior change, and the cool thing is that we've learned a lot about, say, how we form habits and the kinds of situations we can put into place to get people to achieve their behaviors. And we tried to build a lot of that into the course, not least of which is just sort of following up on all the research suggesting that social support can help you. Inadvertently, the course ended up having a tremendous amount of social support just because one out of every four students at Yale was taking it. And so you could just kind of ask a student in the dining hall, what's your gratitude list look like this week? Or, did you exercise this week? It really was a context where the situation was promoting some of this stuff.
You're through with the semester. Do you think the course made any real difference in students' lives?
The sad, heartbreaking thing for my scientist hat is that because we thought it would be, 40 students taking the class, I didn't put rigorous, pre and post measures in to kind of do the science of this stuff. But we do have anecdotal reports, and anecdotally, students who did these practices, who actually did the hard work of the class, self-reported that their well-being went up a lot. Students who are sleeping more, exercising more, even doing things like listing their gratitude at night, they self-reported feeling a lot better and having resilience for bad things. One student who was doing her gratitude letter said she got turned down for a bunch of summer internships, which normally would have, put her through the ringer. But she said, every night I realized I had all these things to be grateful for. Who cares about a few rejections?
I think I have room for one more call. Let's go to Jean in Harrison, Michigan. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm. Quickly, please.
Okay. I'm a sociologist, and I teach at a local community college, and I'm finding that we're getting a high rate of, like she said, a lot of students that are just so stressed, they disappear. A lot of students disappear during the middle of the semester, and we never see them again. I may talk to them from time to time. So I'm wondering, with all the hierarchy that we have in our culture, we have a great social inequality right now, and we also have people who have a lot of long-term depression, and they're being treated even. Are there coping techniques that you teach in this class that can help them kind of rewire their brain back, reset it back to where it needs to be?
Yeah, I mean, in the course, we preach a bunch of very simple habits from just simple healthy behaviors like sleeping 7 to 8 hours a night to exercise. And there's work suggesting that a half hour of exercise every day is equivalent to the antidepressant medication Zoloft. So it's surprisingly simple techniques that can have really big effects.
Well, we've run out of time, but next time we'll have to have you on to talk more about your research.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Earl.
This was fascinating. Maybe we've helped a few people.
Thanks so
on
much.
On college campuses or just general public. Laurie Santos, professor of psychology and head of Silliman College at Yale University. B.J. Lieneman composed our theme music, and if you missed any part of the program, we're all over the place. You can subscribe to our podcasts. If you have a smart speaker, it'll play Science Friday whenever you want to, and of course, we're active on all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, anything new that comes up, you can be sure we will be there. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.